This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 25th of August 2014 on Monocle 24. Culture with Robert Bound in association with Persol. Hello and welcome to the 150th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound. That's right, we're 150 editions old, but we look 250, so we're keeping the anniversary quiet, cats. Today, a ballet aficionado will tell us why his favourite twirly corner of the arts is the best value for money.
When we looked at the number of live performers, it's fantastic. You get all the principals, you get your corps de ballet, all of them sparkling and twinkling away. You get a full orchestra, you get extras to round out every tiny scrap of the stage.
Our man with the roving microphone, Tom Hall, will be at the Liverpool Biennial looking for a needle in a haystack.
I think it's interesting to do projects like this where you're working with an architect. You're actually working with somebody whose job is to understand and challenge our perception of space.
And we'll head to Kosovo's only film festival. It has one at all, you say? Yes, DocuFest.
We still have a long road, yeah, but there's few good filmmakers whose films are travelling, you know what I mean, whose stories have been heard.
Plus, a way of looking back at our own recent past, we'll delve into the Midori House session archive to play three tracks from the not-too-distant, just to give our knob twiddlers here a little break, you see. That's all to come here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. This week, we're 150, a milestone worthy of a little reflection, perhaps. So we're going to play you a few songs from some of our favourite Midori House sessions so far this year. We'll get the ball rolling down memory lane by jumping out of our seats to boogie on down with San Francisco's Nick Waterhouse. Nick and his band paid us a visit back in April, and they've gone down in Monocle history as one of the most fun musical acts to grace us with their presence. Nick played us tracks from his record Holly, but today we're going to play you his cover of Roger and the Gypsies, Past the Hatchet.
Bye. Thank you kindly. Thanks, Monica.
That was Nick Waterhouse with Pass the Hatchet from his Midori House session back in April. More music from Moments Past in the future. Now, we don't do too much on dance and ballet here on The Culture Show because, I don't know, maybe it's tough to translate to the airwaves. And although we've made a nuisance of ourselves down the stalls at the Royal Opera House, maybe we think, like perhaps you do, that it's elitist in the wrong way and that it's simply very expensive. People are trying to change that perception all the time, of course, but the best idea we've heard is from our first guest today, David Jays. David's made an infographic for the None More August Dance Gazette that aims to show that a night watching tights and tutus is in fact the best value cultural experience there is, especially when you consider factors like chances of romance and glamour factor, as much as price per minute spent in front of the spectacle, and just how many people there are to pay for, both on stage and in the orchestra pit. The very charming David Jays came in to wave his flag.
Ballet is unfortunate. It has a bad rap, and people assume, they've assumed several things. They assume it's not for them. They assume it's expensive. They assume it's elitist. They assume it's possibly good for you, but not actually enjoyable. And I think they assume that it's a lot of money in the pursuit of a long, dull evening. And so, starting with that premise, we decided to just playfully look at lots of other different art forms, different cultural and sporting experiences too, just to see how on earth you would start to measure value for money. Because of course it's a ridiculous and impossible thing to measure. You can't measure how the performance that made you cry, or the comedy show that made you snort beer out of your nose, or the sporting fixture which just made you realize for the first time the appalling, crushing disappointment of seeing all of your hopes, everything you've invested in, ground into the dust. How on earth do you put a price on that? So we started to come up with some measures, some of them cheerfully subjective and frivolous.
These are the ones we like.
Good.
Well, some of them were things like the chance of finding romance on a night out. This is stuff like this.
Exactly.
That we like and we want to go into. Yeah.
Exactly. I can't claim that a great deal of science was expended on this measure, though bits of anecdotage came to the fore. But we thought that actually ballet probably did quite well on that measure. All the stories tend to be about love. All the music tends towards the swoonsome. People are a bit dressed up. You're there for an awfully long time. Frankly, marriages have lasted for less time than a slightly slow performance of The Sleeping Beauty.
And I suppose there is a sense of, if we're looking at it in terms of the success of potential romance on a night at the ballet, for example, it is something that it is romantic, isn't it? With a small and a big R. I mean, the style of the music is... Lots of the sets, if we think of maybe not sort of a contemporary rendering of a ballet, but, you know, the classics they're all about romance themselves. It's up to you not to be swept off your feet, presumably.
Absolutely. And the entire progress of a classical Tchaikovsky three-act ballet is about the search for love and finding it and finding that gorgeous pas-de-deux, the perfect balance with the person who, in a very literal way, sweeps you off your feet and possibly holds you above their head and rotates you for a bit, which is, all one can hope for a relationship.
That's what we're looking for, precisely. Exactly. Now, people won't perhaps be surprised to learn that people think that the ballet is romantic, but let's go back to the idea of value, because, as you say, the romance factor is a wonderfully, beautifully, romantically subjective thing to talk about. But what about ticket prices, the amount of the idea of a shared experience, the things you can measure, the metrics and the subjectives?
Well, when it came to the metrics, ballet surprisingly does rather fantastically well. I think there's a myth that sport is where democracy is at, and the arts in general, but especially ballet, opera, theatre, are far more exclusive. But in fact, as we know, premiership tickets are bonkersly stratospheric. And the range of seat prices at, for example, the Royal Opera House, which was the example we chose, is amazingly approachable. For as little as £6, you can be perching, admittedly. You're high up, you're on the side, but you still get the full value of the music. You still get a view of the stage. You can, for some of the more contemporary triple bills, for new work there, you get a fantastic seat for £20, which you can't do in the West End Theatre, really. You can't do at a major sporting occasion. You'll be pushed to do at a gig at the O2. So from that point of view, we thought that ballet was scored surprisingly well. And when we looked at the number of live performers, it's fantastic. You get all the principals, you get your corps de ballet, all of them sparkling and twinkling away. You get a full orchestra, you get extras to round out every tiny scrap of the stage.
So there's an idea then that you're getting bang for your buck in terms of the amount of people employed to entertain you on any given evening at the ballet.
Absolutely.
Outweighs a theatrical production, a purely theatrical production without the music, or a night at the cinema. How does it work between live entertainment and recorded entertainment? Well, the theatre and film, for example.
The other thing you just can't put a value on is the liveness of a live performance. Cinema is attempting some of that, which is why I think there's been this huge explosion of live screenings from the National Theatre here in London, the Metropolitan in New York, the Bolshoi in Moscow. There's a sense that the thing that makes an experience unique is its one-offness, its liveness. Yes, the sense that something can go fantastically wrong, because you always remember the night when the ballerina falls over, but also that something can go heart-stoppingly right. And that a high C can be held, a pirouette can be spun that little bit faster and more whizzily. And I think that's where live performance scores. It's in its liveness.
And another factor of this is the collegiate atmosphere of an audience, which is very important. We talked about football or sporting events. Going into and coming out of the turnstiles at the end of the day at a test match or at a football match, is that's part of the fun. It's a bit of banter with the people behind you and all the rest of it. See, I'm thinking that ballet maybe doesn't score highly on this, that everyone perhaps keeps themselves to themselves.
I'm thinking banter and I'm thinking maybe not, but actually, compared to even the spottiest statistics obsessive soccer geek, I think they have nothing on a true ballet fan. A ballet fan who will have seen every performance of everything several times will have amazingly strong views on Daria's Sleeping Beauty as opposed to Alina's, as opposed to Tamara's. They will, and not just the leading parts, they will spot people in the corps de ballet. They will know who's changed the costumes. They will say that it was better in 1962 when it was already not new. Yeah, a hardcore ballet fan is both obsessive in their enthusiasm and incredibly keen and actually really surprisingly generous about sharing that enthusiasm. They like nothing more than a new recruit.
And this semi-objective, semi-subjective, semi-romantic survey, David, is obviously something that you've done for an art form that you love. Is it intended to go out and grab new punters? Is that part of the thing, that it's a bit of a net to catch prospective punters in?
To an extent, obviously you're kind of preaching to the converted, and this is where the value for money metric falls down, because if your idea of sheer hell is 3 hours with an orchestra playing Tchaikovsky while people in tights and tutus bound around in front of you, then no attempt to draw attention to the number of piccolo players that you're getting for your money is really going to sway you. But hopefully a few minds will be open, a few preconceptions nudged aside. It doesn't have to be an exclusive night out. It can also be fun.
That was David Jays, editor of the Royal Academy of Dance's Dance Gazette magazine.
For those just joining us, you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. From July to October this year, the Liverpool Biennial is taking over the city's galleries, streets and unconventional spaces. Under a theme of A Needle Walks into a Haystack, this year's curators have helped compile a spread of mischievous and playful works that force or invite, perhaps, the viewer to rethink their immediate surroundings. Nothing is as it initially might first appear. The Arts is on show for free at venues across the city, ranging from the Biennial's HQ, a dilapidated Warren-like building in the centre of town, to the Tate Museum out in the docks. And art is in the streets pretty much everywhere in between too. Monocle's Tom Hall went to meet a few of the people helping make the event happen this summer in Liverpool.
I'm at Liverpool's Blind School on Hardman Street, the epicentre of the Liverpool Biennial that this year is all about throwing perspectives on their heads. Biennial director Sally Tallant starts things at the deep end.
So this is a work by Rana Hamadeh, who is an artist based in Lebanon, and she's created a kind of narration or a play, if you like, in the form of a sound work, and it draws from the Shiite ritual of Ashura, where tens of thousands of men and women take to the streets to reenact the slaying of the spiritual leader. And so what we're going to go into now is a sound work that's been installed specifically in the space. The experience of a kind of ritual and what it means to take part in a spiritual procession is what she tried to manifest in the space. The whole floor shakes and you feel the sound running through the body. I think when people are in there, and it builds over quite a long period of time, it's possible to really understand what's happening as a kind of narrative experience.
There's more, of course, and nothing in the building is really as it first appears. Swiss artist Mark Bauer's epic charcoal scrawled vision that spreads 10 by 4 metres across one of the blind school's walls was actually inspired by a small antique photo he chanced upon in a rundown Liverpool hotel room. Whereas pieces such as a diamond-encrusted ring from British artist Chris Evans was designed on request of the artist by local Liverpool jewellers Boodles, who Evans asked to interpret the Biennial's theme. I wonder how much a thing like that might be worth. What do you think? That open-ended discussion is kind of what the Biennial's about. Sally says it's about working the art into people's everyday lives.
The great thing about what we're able to do here during the Biennial is we can take spaces like this, which is a massive building right in the heart of Liverpool, in a really beautiful bit of town next to some of all the best pubs. And people get to rediscover those buildings. There's work outside. I think that idea that you can experience art as part of your everyday life whilst you're doing shopping, whilst you're going to the bank, to me, puts art back into the world, which is where it belongs, surely.
But out in the world, or on the high street at least, talking to random taxi drivers, it's not so clear that Liverpudlians think the Biennial really belongs. Have you guys been to any of the exhibitions or installations around it?
No, just seen them about.
Any other creative people that you rate from Liverpool?
I don't know anyone, I haven't got a clue. Sorry, mate.
And the art community has its own take on the event too.
My name's Roger Hill. I do a lot of things. I work in education, but I also work in the arts. I'm an artist, a performing artist. Well, I haven't quite grasped this particular theme in the same way as I've grasped some of their other ones. I mean, yes, it is about context, but then the Biennial's been going a long time now, and an awful lot of the Biennial exhibitions are actually in places that we know about, places like the Tate, the Open Eye, the Blue Coat, and so we go to them like we would to any exhibition. Up at the what they're calling the Old Blind School, it's basically a co-opted art gallery, so we take our art gallery notions to that. Sometimes the things we see in there are unconventional, and that's good. It's always stimulating to see things that you need to think about. But I don't think the Biennial itself specialises in major changes of context.
Over at the Tate Liverpool on the docks of the Mersey, context is what their contribution to the Biennial is all about. Assistant curator Stephanie Strain talks me through what's going on.
We're seeing a brand new commission by Claude Perrant in our Wolfson Gallery, and Perrant designed the structure specifically for this space, and it's a series of sloping ramps and inclines in which there's works from the Tate collection embedded within the space, and again everything was chosen by Perrant himself.
And he's known as an architect. Has he always combined architecture and art, or is this something new for him as well?
Well, there's one important precedent in the merging of art and architecture, which is a commission he did for the French Pavilion at the Venice Biennale in 1970. And similarly, that was a meeting of art and architecture. And here, it's really Parent's attempt to make a machine for viewing artwork from the collection. And so really, there's a strong link between what he did in Venice over 40 years ago and this new space.
But maybe the setting is the real statement here. Seeing art in unfamiliar environments makes the art itself more interesting. It has to speak louder, compete harder with the world around it, real or reimagined.
That's what's good about it being part of the biennial. It's a space and an occasion for new commissions by people you wouldn't normally work with, and that's what's so interesting about it.
For Monocle, in Liverpool, I'm Tom Hall.
Thanks, Tom. And after the break, we're off to Kosovo to see what went down at this year's DocuFest. Stick around.
The morning show for North America's East Coast is a pacey roundup of the day's main stories. The briefing features informed news reporting, prescient business analysis, and invaluable industry reports from all around the world. Each day we're joined by an expert. Monocle's correspondents and industry insiders are in studio for analysis of the aviation, technology, defence, media and luxury retail sectors. Our friends at Bloomberg and Reuters in London and New York make sense of the latest markets, business and economic data.
I try to avoid the term perfect storm, but it applies so well here that I can't avoid using it.
That's a briefing every weekday at noon London time, 7 a.m. East Coast, here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounds. Every summer, locals and vacationing families flock to the historic town of Prizren in Kosovo, positioned on the slopes of the Saar Mountains and just south of the capital, Pristina. With the majority of the population being Kosovo Albanians, Prizren is also home to communities of Bosnians, Turks and Romani. But in August, the quaint town gets transformed into an exuberant creative summit for international cinema. DocuFest, International Documentary and Short Film Festival, is the largest film festival in Kosovo, and it offers Kosovars something they never had before, access to the worldwide stage of filmmaking. Melanie Sevchenko spent a week in Prizren catching up on the Balkan film scene. She soon realised how essential DocuFest has become to the cultural fabric of a country still feeling the tremors of its turbulent past.
In August, Prizren gets loud. DocuFest brings the people, from near and far. In its outdoor cinemas, under a canopy of stars, international guests and acclaimed filmmakers watch the big picture in the sky. In its 13th year, the festival screens a selection of more than 200 hand-picked films from around the world, across six competitions and in over a dozen special programs. There's also photo exhibitions, workshops, masterclasses, and concert nights. And in the lively, cobbled streets, many gather in outdoor cafes to sip a raki, or local schnapps, in the cool evening breeze, after the scorching sun has fallen behind the mountains. But it wasn't always like this. Cinema culture in Kosovo indeed experienced its share of dark days. And only recently has it started to see the light. Before the war in the late 90s, there were 35 cinema screens in total in Kosovo. Three of them were in Prizren. Veton Nurkolari, the artistic director of DocuFest, explains what happened.
With the war and with the collapse of the whole distribution system, the cinemas collapsed. And it took a couple of years for the only cinema to restart in all of the country. And it took another 12 years for us to be able to bring cinema back to Prizren. So now all of Kosovo has actually two screens.
That's right, only two screens. That's why DocuFest has erected improvised venues in Prizren's center. There's even a cinema on the river that cuts through the town, and another in a castle on the foothills of a mountain. But even then, Kosovo is still missing a cinema-going culture. Most of the audience is not from here. Yet the festival continues its outreach. For over a decade, DocuFest has not only brought documentary cinema to Kosovo, but it's also ignited a filmmaking scene. 8 years ago, their film fund was created.
The fund itself has grown from a few hundred thousand to nearly 1 million, which is, in my opinion, again, a direct consequence of this festival and several other festivals and decision makers understanding finally that it's worth to invest in film, and which in turn, again, brought some recognition.
DocuFest is really something which, when they started from nothing, it was wow. It immediately has some big impact to people, because until then people didn't know what is festival and what is film festival. It's very hard for us to go and visit some other festivals and to see what's going on in the world of cinema today. This is the chance that DocuFest is giving to all the Kosovo people.
Lenita Zakura is a filmmaker from Kosovo. Lenita has a short fiction film screening in competition. Already it's been officially selected in festivals in Venice, Warsaw, Los Angeles, and more. The film is called Balcony. Miraculously, she filmed it in one single 20-minute take between sunset and twilight. Her camera weaves between the actors, most of them never having acted before.
After I finished writing the script, I realized that this is like one shot. I couldn't like cut it, and also because I wanted to have this feeling like being in this Kosovo crowd. For me, it was like a cinematic choice of showing this immersion into the absurd.
With limited resources, Lenita says the filmmaking scene is starting to grow, especially with the younger generation.
They are really so excited by everything and this new technology. Now it's very easy for anyone who has a good idea to go and make this idea. Unfortunately, we don't have much support.
Ivana Totorovic is a Serbian filmmaker whose documentaries tackle social change. Last year, Totorovic won the Best Balkan Documentary Film at DocuFest and was invited back this year to sit on the jury for the Balkan competition.
From Balkan, we always have these hardcore themes. I mean, in general, in Balkan cinema is that we are going towards more personal stories, not just war stories. I mean, they're very important to be told, but, you know, it's good that this new movement of tell personal stories is developing.
Amongst those personal films from the Balkans, stories explore topics of family history, immigration, and mental illness. For Totorovic, she says whether or not a film will break out of the region depends on the strength of the storytelling.
Now when I'm in a jury, you know, I have this opportunity to see like how it's easy for people to get lost, and you need to follow the storyline. Good story travel, so that, you know, applies to the Balkan Dogs. And I think, you know, like we still have a long road, yeah, but there's few good filmmakers whose films are traveling, you know what I mean, whose stories have been heard.
DocuFest continues to attract a bigger international audience. Each year, the juries and guests span globally renowned filmmakers, educators, curators, and critics. And amongst them, Oscar and Emmy recipients. This year, masterclasses were held with award-winning journalist and best-selling author David France and Oscar-winning editor Linz Klingman, along with a storytelling workshop led by celebrated cinematographer and director Richard Pierce. Fetan Nurkolari says the appeal of DocuFest lies with its solid program and its creative spirit in bringing screens to the most unusual of places. And of course,
it's in the tradition of people here to open up their homes, their hearts, and they offer their hospitality.
Every evening, DocuFest offers its guests a free community dinner of local home-cooked cuisine, courtesy of Nurkolari's friends. So, with the right filmmakers in the ideal setting, and a program that includes a conference on technology, as well as a concert series, will DocuFest become the South by Southwest of the Balkans?
Actually, our aspiration is geared toward education through film and teach young people basics of filmmaking with the hope that more films are being produced. So, I don't know, maybe we turn out to be a South by Southwest of the Balkans. Nothing against it. But again, I think our aim is to educate.
And while traditional customs still play a strong part in Kosovo's society, Dokufest's 2014 slogan, "Change it yourself," is certainly doing its part to change culture in their country. For Monocle, in Prizren, Kosovo, I'm Melanie Savchenko.
Thank you, Melanie, and get thee to the DocuFest. Still to come in part two, we'll take a tour of Berlin via some teeny tiny but beautifully designed books. We'll have a couple more tracks from the crème de la crème of this year's Midori House Sessions, and we round off the summer's festival reports with a trip to Alberta, Canada for the Edmonton Folk Festival. That's all to come here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Now for another song. Today we're playing you some of our favourite Midori House sessions from this year so far. Back in the spring, American Sisters in Rock, the Pierces, dropped by to sing us a few songs, and I think they might have set a few Midori House hearts aflutter too. They played us tracks from their album Creation, which is out now, and from it, this is Kings.
What strikes fear in the heart of one man might not even move another, while a stranger gets your hand, you turn your back upon your brother, and you know, you know, you know, you know, we all want the highest towers and the valleys at our feet. We are counting down the hours till a life of love will meet, and you know, you know, you know, you know, you know, it's gonna take some time. If we want to, we could do what kings do. I could feel the earth move when you speak. If we fight through all the things we once knew, everything could change for me. We could do what kings do. You feel unworthy of the throne, you have forgotten who you are. We all had the blood of angels and we fell from the same star. The heart of a lion and the lips of a child. One part of you is dying and the other you know, you know, you know, you know, you know. It's gonna take some time. If we want to, we could do what kings do. I could feel the earth move when you speak. If we fight through all the things we once knew, everything could change for me and you. We could do what kings do. Oh, 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 it's gonna take some time. It's gonna take some time. If we want to, we could do what kings do. I could feel the earth move when you speak. If we fight through all the things we once knew, everything could change for me and you. We could do what kings do. Kings do. Oh, we could do what kings do. Oh, we could do what kings do. Oh, we could do what kings do.
That was the Pierces with Kings, and to hear the full session, you can download episode 129 of Culture from monocle.com or iTunes. This is Culture on Monocle 24, and I'm Robert Bound. Now for something colourful, informative, entertaining, and small enough to fit in a pocket, and it feeds you bite-sized chunks of entertainment while you're on the go. It's not the latest smartphone or high-tech gadget, but the product of a young publishing company in Berlin called Redux. Susan Stone has our report.
Redux publishes teeny books, mostly in translation. Our books are a small format, A5, and they're 32 to 64 pages in length. And they always feature really great design by Berlin illustrators.
Amanda DeMarco's teeny books are the result of some big ideas, like offering small but perfectly formed prose for about the price of a high-quality coffee, and bringing attention to great untranslated classic and contemporary German writing by presenting it in bite-sized pieces alongside new English language stories and essays by newcomers like Brittany Sonnenberg and Gideon Lewis Krauss.
Sometimes translated literature gets put in this funny box that's world literature. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me because I just think of them as great stories. And I wanted to make sure that they were understood in that context, that they could appear next to an American or British author, and that there was nothing strange about that.
Modern Swedish writers, including Amanda Svensson and Malte Persson, have also joined the Redux ranks, thanks to a partnership with Stockholm-based Novelix, whose small book format inspired DeMarco. But the possibilities are vast, like DeMarco's reading list.
It's really organic. It's what I happen to find. And I think because I'm here, it's a really fertile ground for finding amazing writing about Berlin. I think that I could just as easily see us doing some amazing little books about Paris or London, and that actually maybe the larger theme is that people like to hear about cities.
Still, a third of Redux's 12 books deal with charting the change of the German capital, an almost timeless theme. Redux is spelled with an extra A, by the way, like reading, but it also does in fact revive some texts that time forgot, or at least English language publishers. Essays about Berlin written by Otto Eloesser in 1919 and Franz Hessel in 1929 have a cult following, though they've never been translated into English.
And that's one that German bookstores tend to stock because they're so happy that, oh, someone translated Hessel.
One of the latest Redux books to look at the city's change is modern flaneur David Wagner's Berlin Triptych. It was translated by Katie Derbyshire, who has been involved with Redux from the start.
They're books from Berlin, but not just for Berliners, I hope. And then possibly the business aspect of it is kind of trying to tap into the interest and enthusiasm about Berlin in the rest of the world. And I hope that by having a kind of insider's very literary take, people can learn different things about Berlin to what we get from through other channels.
The three essays in Wagner's Berlin Triptych explore the city's evolution. He walks the streets, ruminates, and records.
You have the East, you have Schönhauser Allee, and you have the West with Café M, which is more or less a place, I would say, of the 80s. And I went there in the early 90s, and in a way, longing for the 80s, I missed in the city because I was still in school in West Germany and was longing for Berlin and David Bowie and Nick Cave and Blixer Bargeld in Café M. Yeah? So I have the chance to look back. The third piece in the book is something which is West and East. It's the Friedrichstraße, which was, like before the war, one of the most important or emblematic streets of Berlin.
Wagner's texts have an amused tone, tinged with melancholy, for an imperfect urbanity of this city so marked by history, divided and uneasily reunited.
Schönhauser Allee. Wo Schönhausen liegt, weiß der Besitzer des Imbisses, der Tag Schwein gut sau billig Nacht heißt, nicht.
His kiosk is just after the barely perceptible bend in the road at which Berliner Straße changes its name on its way down from Pankow and becomes Schönhauser Allee. Outside his kiosk, the pavement is padded with green carpeting on which white plastic chairs rehearse the reclamation of public space. There are drinkers here at 8 in the morning.
A travelogue of everyday life, not tourist destinations.
It could be a guide to this recent Berlin past and to the Berlin of today. And I have to say, I like these little books very much. It's a nice concept to have. You can easily have it always on you. And
it's a good book to take for a walk.
I think so, yeah.
Katie and David and I set off, starting just past Rosa Luxemburg Platz. Gentrification's slick fingers have filled in the bombed-out lots that were here in the 90s, but perfection is far from reached.
Oh, no. You're reaching the Schönhauser Allee. Hast du die ganze Zeit aufgenommen?
Nein, nur gerade.
And when I come here, I always think, oh, I forgot to write about this. I left out this. And here's Pfefferberg, which used to be really a ruin. And now I'm used to it. But for a while, it was very strange to have these super perfect places here in Berlin, where everything used to be so improvised. The city felt even more empty 20 years ago, and people coming from Paris or Barcelona, they always said, yeah, it's a nice city, but where are the people? Yeah, and I think this has changed a little bit, but still you can find areas in Berlin where they used to hardly see anyone on the street. And
we have the train.
Yeah, the train is coming out of the ground here.
Walking and talking at a leisurely pace, it takes us about 30 minutes to reach Schönhauser Allee's bustling center.
So if you're coming to the crossroads of Schönhauser and Eberswalde, there you have a spot which gives you an idea of an urban crossroad.
That crossroads is for me a little bit like what they say about Trafalgar Square: if you stand there long enough, the world will pass you by.
Yeah.
And Schönhauser Ecke, on the crossroads of Schönhauser and Eberswalde, I always run into people I know there. Because so many people are changing trains, changing trams, going out for the evening around here. It's a fun place to be. Maybe that's Berlin's Trafalgar Square. It's maybe not quite as attractive, but there's a few pigeons. Right? Yeah.
Wagner's essay on Schönhauser Allee ends like this.
Schönhauser, du schreibst einen Text, der nie fertig wird.
Schönhauser, you're writing a piece that never ends. Redux Books, too, will keep going and evolving. They've just held a new German fiction competition. The winners will be published by Redux this fall. And Amanda DeMarco is currently at work on her first themed series, planned for 2015, an international set of erotica. For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Susan Stone.
Thank you, Susan, and you can pick up Redux publications in bookstores around the world. They're well worth a look. For more information, head to redux.net. You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. After the break, we head to Canada for the closing act in our festival dispatches.
The Globalist provides insight and analysis of the key news and business stories in Europe and the Middle East. Informed, engaging and authoritative, it's a 60-minute bulletin of news, features and opinion. Two presenters in London are joined by guests in our studio and all around the world, including Monocle's editors and friends in our Hong Kong and Tokyo bureau. The Globalist also features an extended daily newspaper review with a special guest here in Midori House. And of course, we round up the business headlines with an expert analyst in a key city. All that and more every weekday at 6 a.m. London time on The Globalist.
You are tuned in to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. And to finish off our summer festival series, we head north to Edmonton, Alberta. Being the jumping-off point for the Alberta oil sands, the province capital isn't typically a hotspot for festival-goers, but the Edmonton Folk Fest proves to be a gem in the city's festival crown. The August event continues to sell out every year, and performers regularly want to play at the festival again. Monocle's Sheena Rossiter takes us on a trip to Edmonton.
The sounds of Vance Joy's music makes its way up Gallagher Hill on Edmonton Folk Fest opening night, with about 20,000 people firmly planted on their lawn chairs looking down at the main stage. Their camped out tarps populate the hillside as everyone sits back and listens to the music, some with a candle in hand. But this isn't a scene of any typical summer festival where music goers come once and then cross it off their music festival list. These concert goers are loyal and make the Edmonton Folk Fest part of their annual routine. Every August for the past 34 years, Edmonton's Gallagher Park, which normally acts as a ski hill in the wintertime, transforms itself for 4 days into what's better known as the Edmonton Folk Fest. The festival has a solid reputation now, But during the early years, it was an uphill battle.
We didn't have money. We were broke when we took a chance. We rolled the dice and said, how about if we made it better? How about if we kept making it better every year?
That's festival producer Terry Wickham. He's been the man in charge of finding and scheduling the some 65 acts for the festival, which weaves together folk, Celtic, bluegrass, blues, roots, gospel, and world beat acts for the past 26 years. He explains what has made the festival a success over the years.
We kept charging more, but we kept making the music better, and we kept making everything better. We just said, our philosophy is to make it better all the time, and we listened. If you're doing the same thing in the same place at the same time every year, you kind of get to recognize what's a good idea from a bad idea. That's kind of the recipe.
But he says all of this wouldn't be possible without one special ingredient, so to speak, that really glues the whole festival together.
The secret ingredient is the volunteers. That's what it keeps it really affordable, so we're not driven by price, and you can bring your own water and your own food if you want. When we had no money, it didn't seem as vital because we were broke, but it really was the key, the economic key, you know, to have 2,300 people working for you for nothing. And they do it really well because they bring a passion to it that you can't buy. It's because of community and family and tradition. I think everybody wants to be part of something that's bigger and better than themselves. And collectively, when everybody comes together at this festival, it is collectively better than any one of us. And I think that's what it really attracts people, as well as the music or community or friends or going drinking, whatever it is.
Now, I have to admit, I'm not exactly the biggest fan of folk music. But nonetheless, the Edmonton Folk Fest was still a festival that I frequented while I was a student at the University of Alberta, here in my hometown of Edmonton. But as Terry Wickham puts it, many people, like myself, are attracted to the festival for reasons other than music. The festival is more about the sense of community that is brought to the city. It's almost as if it brings people together in what seems like a peaceful, euphoric bubble for an extended weekend. I keep coming back, regardless if I haven't heard of everyone on the lineup or not, just for the pure fact that I get to see old friends who I otherwise wouldn't see. But with high-profile acts like Ben Harper playing a blues-infused set, Zimbabwe's Makumba blasting their African fusion beats, and with Phosphorescent fresh off his European tour, all on this year's lineup, it was an easy choice to head back to the folk festival after missing out for the past 7 years. As Terry Wickham puts it, this festival doesn't just highlight great artists, but it also shows how a smaller city can host a great festival.
You know, it's kind of a tribute to Canada. I come from Ireland, and I don't think you can hold something like this. It's about the stories as much as the music, and everybody has one. It's Edmonton's festival.
In an ever-changing music industry, many music festivals are struggling to survive throughout the years. But with no signs of the sold-out music festival becoming vacant anytime soon, the longevity of the Edmonton Folk Fest proves that it's one fire that still burns bright on the North American festival circuit. For Monocle, in Edmonton, I'm Sheena Rossiter.
Thank you, Sheena, and that brings us to the end of this week's show. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bowne. My producer was Holly Fisher, who's kept me in lem sips and hot teas through this coldy old post-Green Man week. Time for one final song from a lady whose voice knocked our socks off back in March. Eska is a British singer-songwriter who we think has soul and spirit running through her veins. Here she is playing the title track from her EP Gatekeeper. Hold on to your hats, people. And thank you, as ever, for tuning in.
Gatekeeper, where there's no wise leader, there'll be no brighter lighter. But you keep letting it in, let it in, let it, let it in, let it, let it in. Gatekeeper, here is your reminder. There is a kinder teacher. Mm-hmm.
heart, will you let him in? Let him in, let him, let him in, let him, let him in.
Take your stand when you get